Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about a worry that seems to be quite common and is something, though, that even though it's pretty common, is not something that people talk easily about. And what we're talking about here is the worry that other people will think that we are failures. Our guest for the program is Alain de Botton, and he's written a book on this, which he titles Status Anxiety. And here's the way he writes about it in the introductory sections of the book. He writes, every adult life could be said to be defined by two great love stories. The first, the story of our quest for sexual love, is well known and well charted. The second, the story of our quest for love from the world, is a more shameful and a more secret and shameful tale. And yet this second love story is no less intense than the first. Pantheon is the publisher of the book. The author is spending some time traveling around the United States talking about it, and we are pleased to have him with us this morning by telephone. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He has written 7 books, 3 novels. His fourth, and that was the first nonfiction work, was How Proust Can Change Your Life. That was in 1997. Following that, he wrote The Consolations of Philosophy, which was made into a television documentary for British television. And after that, the book that he wrote, this was in 2002 and most recent before Status Anxiety, was an exploration of why it is that we go traveling. That book was titled The Art of Travel. And all of his nonfiction works have sold very well in the United States, in the UK, and elsewhere in the English-speaking world. He is, as I said, he's on the West Coast this morning. He's spending some time traveling around talking about the book, and will be talking with us. And if there are people who are listening who have questions, they're welcome. We like to get people involved in conversation. The only thing we ask is that people are brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many people as possible. But anyone can call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, anywhere around Illinois or Indiana, or if you might happen to be listening on the Internet. As long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free number. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Alain de Botton, hello.
Yes, hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
What got you interested in this subject?
I think it's a subject that all of us feel. I know that I feel it. The thing that I call status anxiety, it's a kind of feeling that you might experience at all sorts of moments of everyday life. Let's say you hear about a colleague who's been promoted above you, or you hear about a party and you're not on the guest list, or a friend of yours from school moves into a much bigger house. It's the kind of area that I think Gore Vidal was talking about when he made his famous quip, every time a friend of mine succeeds, a small part of me dies. Yeah. So it's that sort of awkward area about winning and losing and being a success and a failure. And I think it is something, this is something that often we feel very ashamed to bring up in conversation. Yeah. And so one of my hopes for the book is just to get people talking about a subject that I think troubles all of us. And can make life very, very unpleasant.
You make an interesting point there, and that is that some people might argue, first of all, that status anxiety doesn't get one anywhere. We set that notion aside. But at least people do seem to be realistic in the sense that when they pick people to compare themselves against, they generally pick people who are close, relatively close to them, say of their own class, of their own background. So probably there aren't a lot of people who are of the middle class, for example, who are thinking, gee, I wish I was Bill Gates. Because that's just too big a jump. But what they're doing is they're looking at their neighbors, they're looking at their friends, they're looking at people that they work with and measuring themselves against people who are close to them.
Yeah. I think that that's right in theory, that definitely anything which draws you close to someone increases the danger of envy. So people tend to envy people of their own gender, of their own age group, of their own, you know, in their own geographical vicinity, etc. But that said, I think one of the features of the modern world is that we're actually encouraged to compare ourselves to people who in previous ages we would have known, you know, nothing about. And in fact, there's a constant literature and voices telling us, you know, you could become anything. You know, why not compare yourself to Bill Gates? You know, why just compare yourself to, you know, the people around you? And this is very much a voice that we hear in the modern United States and in many parts of Europe too, that really anyone can become anything. And thanks to the media, we are taken right into the lives of people who in previous ages we would never have compared ourselves to. But now, because we know, you know, where these famous and rich people live and what they have for breakfast and who they're dating, etc., these people can actually become targets of envy in a way which they wouldn't have done in the past.
Hmm. Why is it that status is important to us?
Well, partly it's important to us because it very much determines how other people will treat us. You know, one of the first things that people ask when they first meet is what do you do? And according to how you answer that question, people will either be incredibly pleased to see you or will say, oh, is that the time? And, you know, try and run away quickly. So a lot hangs on this. I say that we're surrounded in a way by a world of snobs. Now, the word snob is often associated with an old-fashioned British interest in, you know, dukes and duchesses, etc. I think that's no longer the kind of snobbery that most of us will encounter. You know, modern snobbery is career snobbery. It's according to what you're doing that you'll be evaluated. Now, the opposite of the snob is your mother. So one's ideal mother. Because the thing about your mother, ideally, some mothers are snobs, and that's complicated, but ideally your mother doesn't care what you do. She cares what you are. But most people are not our mothers, and that explains our interest in getting hold of some of the things that we can use to prove that to other people that we are important, we're worth listening to, we are not nobodies, we are not losers, all of which are very painful things to be labeled. So it's, at some level, our search for status is a search for respect and dignity. And you know, I think a lot of the things that we do we do for status. You know, a lot of the reason why we work isn't just for money, it's also for the status that certain jobs bring. You know, a lot of what makes low-paid work unpleasant isn't just the low pay, it's the lack of respect and dignity that comes with those jobs, just as a lot of what makes highly paid work interesting isn't just the high pay. Again, it's the respect that comes from accumulating wealth in our current society.
Mm. It seems pretty clear that status anxiety is becoming more intense. And as you say, it has something to do, perhaps it has something to do with rising standards of living. It has something to do with the fact that luxury goods with which we associate status are more accessible than they have been. That is, the societies that we live in is more open, and there is possibility for mobility. And modern media tends to give a lot of attention to certain individuals and the way that they live. So that sort of all of these things go together to set up a situation where status anxiety not only would exist, but you would expect it to be intense. Having said all that, do you think that status anxiety has always, knowing that's a sweeping term to use, has almost always been with us?
I think that there are definitely features of the modern age which hugely aggravate something which may, as you hint, have at some level always been part of you know, of human life. But as soon as, I mean, the story really starts, I guess, with the foundation of the United States, the world's first society, which totally does away with a caste-like system, a sort of feudal system of judging where people should go, and basically tells people that, you know, anyone can become anything, and that your status is not something you should inherit, either high status or low status, and, you know, really the sky's the limit. And that does cause complications, and I guess you get a sense of them if you go into any large American bookstore and you look at the self-help shelves. There are basically two kinds of books on those shelves. Firstly, there are those books about, you know, how you could become anything, you know, how to become a billionaire by Friday, etc. And then the other kinds of books are books telling you how to cope with low self-esteem. And I think that the two genres are actually related. You know, it's by the time it's Saturday and you haven't become a billionaire that you're going to be reaching out for something to make you feel better about yourself. So there's a real relationship between a society which tells its members that there should be no limit to their achievement and a feeling of unworthiness, a feeling of shame in many of those members of these societies who will simply feel that they've failed to measure up to the standards that have been laid down.
Hmm. So you really think it's the case, I, I would imagine that in the past, particularly among the people who had the most status in society, there would have been status anxiety because they were comparing themselves against other people who had whatever there was in terms of status and wealth and power. You think that in particularly in feudal societies that people who were on the bottom realized that there just was no chance for nobility, so there was no point in feeling bad because you didn't live in the castle on the hill when you knew that if you were born to be a farmer,
right,
and your dad was a farmer and your grandfather and your great grandfather and so forth, that there was,
sure,
just there was no point to, in thinking about that because there was simply no way in which that situation into which you were born could be transcended.
Sure. And, you know, I think we can feel it with all sorts of things. I mean, imagine if I suddenly told you that there was a new kind of mass transportation whereby human beings could be emailed across America, but this was only available to the very rich. Now, suddenly we would think, oh, why do we have to take the plane and the train? It's so boring, whereas other people can be emailed across the continent. We would suddenly start to feel very unhappy and poor in an area where previously we hadn't felt poor. It's a ludicrous example, but what I'm trying to say here is that as soon as you know there's an alternative, you can feel that something is lacking. So as soon as you tell people there could be some other way of living, then people will want that. And I think this is generally what's happened. Now, another feature that's happened, and this could sound rather strange, is the idea that our societies are now more or less just and fair. You know, in older sort of feudal societies, those at the top of society, it was well known that they hadn't got their privileges by being better people or more hardworking. They'd probably stolen their privileges. They'd killed someone. They'd inherited their castle or whatever. So the idea was society is not fair and not just. Now, for about the last 200 years, politicians on all sides of the political spectrum have argued that we must try and set up what gets called a meritocracy, a society where anyone with merit should be able to get to the top, where if you have talent, you should be, you should have an equal access to education, and you should be able to fulfill yourself. Now, in a way, it's a beautiful idea, very nice idea, but it does carry a nasty trick in the tail for anyone who's contemplating failure. Because if you genuinely believe in a meritocracy, that means believing that those at the top necessarily deserve their success, just as those at the bottom necessarily deserve their failure. So an element of shame enters into the distribution, an element of justice enters into the distribution, not just of the rewards in society, but also of the punishments. And that explains why we might feel more ashamed about being at the bottom of society, in a society that thinks it's a meritocratic one, than in a society where it's known that those at the top haven't necessarily done anything good to get there. And I think you can look at this in language, that 300 years ago in England, those at the bottom of society were described as unfortunates. Their plight was described as unfortunate. Nowadays, people at the bottom of society are called losers. And of course, that word is much more punitive and harsh. But it really reflects our sense that life is, society is set up as a game, a more or less fair game with a level playing field, and those who succeed deserve their success, and maybe those who fail deserve their failure. So an element of shame is made to be felt there. We've done away with the idea of luck, with the idea of contingent forces influencing our lives. There's that modern expression, winners make their own luck. And that's kind of what we feel, that we are in charge of our destiny, and so you should be able to judge people by looking at what actually happens to them. Look at someone's resume, look at someone's earning pattern, and you'll be able to tell whether these people are good or bad, worthwhile or not worthwhile.
Our guest is Alain de Botton. He's the author of three novels and three works of nonfiction, including The Art of Travel, The Consolations of Philosophy, and How Proust Can Change Your Life. And they're all out there in bookstores now, available in paperback if you'd like to look at them. He makes his home in London. He's spending some time in the United States talking about his most recent book, Status Anxiety. It's published by Pantheon. And what it is here we're talking about is, to put it very bluntly, the worry that other people will feel that we are losers. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It seems that the thing that we're talking about is behind a lot of the preoccupation that we seem to have nowadays with material goods and that part of our standard of living.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very often we hear that people are getting ever more greedy, you know, that people are very materialistic. And I think that's kind of wrong. I mean, I think we're not a particularly materialistic society as such. We're a society that has invested material goods with emotional meanings. And I think a lot of the reason why people want certain material goods isn't for, you know, material reasons. It's for emotional reasons. It's to a large extent to be respected, to be taken seriously. You know, next time you see someone in a Ferrari, this isn't just someone with an interest in, you know, fast Italian engineering. This is someone who's using a car to make what is at heart an emotional plea, which is, please be nice to me. And the thing is that people tend to be nicer to you if you arrive at a party in a Ferrari rather than on a bicycle. So, you know, that's not wholly wrong. And there's a kind of emotional poignancy to our search for luxury goods and luxury brands. These are the things that we surround ourselves with to signal to other people, to signal to snobs that that we are actually, you know, worthwhile and worth talking to.
How though? I wonder if how does one balance this kind of envy that we have of people who have things, who seem to be loved and who have a way of living that we would like. It does seem that kind of envy is often balanced by and sometimes overweighed by resentment, and that's one of the reasons that we enjoy seeing celebrities brought low.
Yes, I mean, I think envy, perhaps it's worth sort of saying a few things in favor of envy. I mean, I don't feel that all envy is bad. You know, I think that in any good life, you have to envy some people because otherwise you would never know what you wanted and what you aspired to. You know, it's natural. Let's say, you know, say you want to be a scientist one day, you will probably have to start by envying other scientists. And by that I mean thinking, oh, I'd like to be like that, you know. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I think there's also a worse kind of envy whereby we can be incited to envy things that actually we don't particularly need, that wouldn't make us happy even if we got them. And there's a weird way in which we're incredibly susceptible to what people around us are talking about and saying. So, you know, if you join a conversation where everyone is telling you that having a flat-screen TV is just really the best thing and, you know, any normal human being should have one, by the end of that conversation, you'll be thinking, well, God, I really envy people with flat-screen TVs. That's something I really need. So, and what actually, it might not be that connected to anything we sincerely need, and, you know, perhaps our energies should better be directed elsewhere. But we're very open to suggestions about things we need. And I think this is what makes, you know, the media a very difficult or very sort of tricky thing, because often through the media we pick up ideas about the sort of things that we need and want, even though perhaps we don't actually need and want these things. You know, open any newspaper or magazine and you'll find suggestions of what a good life is, a good marriage, a good job, a good vacation, etc. And some of these suggestions are really incredibly unhelpful to what we're actually trying to achieve.
So it does indeed go beyond material markers of success. There are other things that are maybe one couldn't hold in one's hand, but they're also important to this notion that we are successful.
Yes, I mean, it could be, you know, chiefly in our society, it's the job that you do so that you get weird ways in which, you know, someone like Bill Gates, you know, wears jeans and kind of looks like an ordinary guy, whereas, you know, because really his status is brought to him not by his clothes, but by his job title. And it's often actually people who don't have very impressive job titles who are most drawn to surrounding themselves with very, very ostentatious consumer goods to compensate again for a feeling of being invisible. So, but in all cases, you know, the underlying psychology is the feeling that we are not important enough, we're not valued enough. And I think there's a sort of, you know, the psychology of it really is that whatever your status today, all of us used to have once upon a time an extremely high status. You know, if you think of the way that children and babies are treated, you know, they're treated in a way that a Roman emperor would have envied. If they're hungry, someone brings them their dinner. If they don't like it, they can throw it on the floor. Someone will pick it up. You know, all you have to do as a child to get noticed and thought cute is to sort of wave a toy around and everyone will smile. Now, if by the age of 25 you're still throwing your dinner on the floor and your social graces don't extend beyond waving a toy around, no one's going to be that impressed. Suddenly you have to start to achieve. That's the only, going to be the only way to being noticed and recognized and treated nicely. There's a lovely quote from George Orwell where he says, after 20, no one cares if you're nice. The implication being, you know, it's what you do that counts. And that explains a lot of our anxiety about this. It's not simply financial. There's also this tricky thing of status.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's start with a listener in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that idea of meritocracy because I think what values equal merit has changed in the last 20 years. And I'll use the example of Mr. Bush. When he spoke at a commencement address, he said, look what a C average can do. And there was a tremendous response from the graduating students. And in other words, he was saying it's cunning, not intelligence, that is merits. And I think that's proven or at least supported by a book that's recently come out in the U.S. where this gentleman just looks at the myriad of ways in which we cheat in our society. And I think that when people are calling you a loser, it's because you're a loser because you don't know how to play the game, because obviously if you had enough cunning to play the game, you wouldn't be a loser. And we see examples of that type of dishonesty just constantly in our society. Some people are exposed in their dishonesty, some people are not. But I think that you really need to be careful when you say meritocracy to remind everyone that we're not talking about the same values. We're not talking about truth and honesty and intelligence that might make someone succeed. It might be simply your ability to dissemble.
Yes, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. It seems to me, I mean, in all honesty, I think that the very word meritocracy is a completely crazy one. I don't think you can ever have a meritocracy. And by that I mean you can never really have a society where all those at the top totally deserve their success and all those at the bottom totally deserve their failure. There are simply too many factors. You know, there's luck and accident and biology and chance and cunning and intelligence. All these things are sort of thrown into the pot and will mean that some people rise and some people fall and some people take a steady job and others strike it lucky and blah, blah, blah. But so the very concept that we can arrange society in this totally just way is simply conceptually impossible. And I think that, you know, all these debates about tinkering with the school system, with the grading system, the SAT and quotas, etc., yes, there may be something in that, but at the end of the day, we always have to remember that we can never produce a totally fair society. And I think actually the belief that society is fair will lead you, as I was trying to suggest earlier, to a cruelty. Because if you believe that society is totally fair, you will not be nice to anyone at the bottom. Because anyone at the bottom must then totally deserve to be there. So my own natural sympathies lie much more with an old-fashioned view that you find in a lot of Jewish and Christian thought. And that's the idea that it's really that no human being can ever really judge the merit of another human being. That only God can do this. And he can only do this, you know, on the day of judgment with the help of 1,000 angels and a big pair of scales. Completely crazy idea from a secular point of view. But I think an interesting corrective to the impulse that we sometimes have, which is to say, you know, show me your resume and I will show you how good you are. It's not that simple. There is no immediate relationship between, you know, the grades you got, the amount you're earning, etc., and your true merit as a human being. And it's sort of mad to think there might be.
Well, I think one example of what you just you said about the cruelty of assuming that society is fair, certainly in the United States, once the Civil Rights Act was passed, it was very convenient for the majority of white establishment to say that now all things are fair for people of color. And especially the more conservative people have often used this as an argument to say now that everything is fair because we've had this passage of this act, and ignoring all the other factors in our society that are unfair. And there is a really very much a punitive attitude towards people, which is certainly exhibited by the changes that they've made in welfare laws,
right,
assuming that everything is now fair. So, yes, I think you're totally right in that statement.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, if you believe that you can take the credit for your success, you know, then you have to take the credit for your failure, and there is that approach. I mean, you'll find people in the United States, I hear people talking about white trash, trailer trash, incredibly pejorative terms, which really strike, you know, when you're coming from Europe, that those sentences really leap out at you, and you think, oh, my God, people are actually talking like this. Now, I confronted someone that I knew about this kind of language, and he told me, well, you know, the thing is that I didn't get to where I was. He was working as a lawyer, earning, you know, good salary, etc. He was saying, look, I didn't get to where I was by anyone giving me something. I struggle from absolutely nothing. And, you know, quite frankly, if other people don't struggle as I have, if they end up in temporary accommodation, etc., it's their fault. And that seemed to me, you know, and he was an otherwise, a, you know, nice guy, etc. But it's interesting how if you really believe in a just system, it will almost naturally lead you to that kind of opinion.
Well, the other aspect, though, is the American individualism. We never, as Americans, in our political culture, the assumption is that everyone is making it on their own. Everyone is the frontiers man or woman, which is totally untrue. But we, unlike Europe, have not maintained our concept of community and society being a community.
Right, that's
and
right.
We like to force that idea that everyone's doing it on their own.
That's right. I mean, the whole concept of a self-made man is, again, crazy. You only have to ask the mother of the self-made man. You know, was he really self-made? No, of course he wasn't. You know, he was in nappies for a long time, blah, blah, blah. A whole community looked after him so that he could then go off and say, I'm self-made. You know, no one is self-made. We are all dependent on community, most immediately on our parents and on our caregivers in our early years. And then continuing on, we're all interconnected. We're all relying on each other. And so I agree, this concept that we've all sort of sprung up independently, you know, can lead to people taking too much credit and too much blame.
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I want to thank her for her comments. We have a couple of other people you want to get to. We're already past the midpoint, and I feel that I should introduce once again our guest for anyone who has tuned in here in the last 5 or 10 minutes, Alain de Botton. He's a writer. He's written 3 novels and 3 works of nonfiction. They are The Art of Travel. That's the most recent. We're going back here in time. The Art of Travel, The Consolations of Philosophy, and How Proust Can Change Your Life. And his most recent book is about this issue that we're discussing here this morning. He titles it Status Anxiety. It's published by Pantheon. He makes his home in London, and he is now spending some time in the United States talking about his newest book. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, line 1.
Yeah, your discussion reminds me of a book that was written quite a number of years, Marshall McLuhan's, The Medium is a Message. And he had one chapter that was titled Keeping Upset with the Joneses. And what he really talked about was advertising. And, you know, what a bearing that has and even creating even, you know, a greater problem when you think of it. You know, part of the idea is to keep you unhappy that this one has this, so you should have that, which motivates you to get that, you know.
Sure. I mean, I think that advertising is one of the incredible tools of our society that makes people want things and makes people – that the job of a good advertisement is to make you unhappy about something that's lacking in your life. You know, if you come away from an advert smiling, you know, the advertisers have gone wrong. And I think this is the real problem of a feeling of wealth. It's incredibly hard to keep feeling wealthy in a society which keeps suggesting that actually in order to be wealthy, you need many more things than you currently have. So a sense of wealth, a sense of success is all relative to what people around you have. And if you see other people around you having more, you can suddenly start to feel poor. Which is why, in a sense, the best way to start to feel rich is not to try and make more money, because as soon as you do that, you'll meet people with more money. But it's to try and sort of cut yourself off from reminders of other people's wealth and success. You know, surround yourself with people who are doing less well, and you will feel rich. I mean, it's a facetious point, but it takes us right to the heart of the issue, which is a feeling of well-being is dependent on a sense of what it's normal and right to have. And things like advertising constantly inflate our sense of the number of things and the kind of life that you need to have in order to be okay.
But, you know, you have another concept here. And when television came along and the poor particularly African Americans, all of a sudden saw this wonderful suburb with all this thing and all that, and was referred to as relative deprivation. So that we also have that going on. And actually, what really concerns me is one time it was the automobile, and he only could spend so much for an automobile. Now we're back on the house, you know, building these castles, you know, bigger and bigger just to show that, you know, we're much better.
Right. Now, a lot of this, you know, behind a lot of this urge to build bigger houses and show off, et cetera, is really a fear of what it would be like to be ordinary. And I think this takes right to the heart about the discussions about the community, because there are some societies in which to be ordinary is not a problem. You know, I was just in New Zealand, and if you're an ordinary New Zealander, you've got a very nice quality of life. You know, your house is nice, schools are good, the air is clean, etc. So in a way, there's no shame to being an ordinary New Zealander. But in many societies, perhaps in the States, perhaps in Britain where I live, to be ordinary is much more in question. It might mean that you have no health care. It would mean that your job is insecure, that your house might not be that nice, that you might have a long way to travel to, that your kids' education would not be great, etc. Now, in those sort of circumstances, the desire to be special, to be really different, to say, look, I'm not like everyone else, I've got a huge castle, you know, I live behind gates, etc. The desire to shut yourself off from other people is basically a frightened reaction. And the fear comes when being ordinary, when being just an ordinary member of the community, has become too associated with a very degraded standard of life. So it's there's a kind of paradox in which you get more status anxiety, more desire for high status, the more the idea of being ordinary comes to seem frightening and humiliating.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. The next caller is on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Yes, what is interesting about this whole concept, and you probably maybe you've alluded to it, but the concept of the lawyers, who I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, well, the fact is that not everybody can be the super rich, and not everybody can, because somebody has to work at McDonald's, somebody has to work at Walmart, and the system has a ranking system, whether it is your ability to get an education or whether or not it excludes people constantly. You can't get into the best schools unless you have either the best genetic background or the best family background or a combination of both. And these, it's just rather ironic that we're always aspiring and not being satisfied, but I think it is a direct relationship with our advertising, and that's how the capitalism keeps things going. If everybody became satisfied with what they have, then productivity would go down, at least in producing more goods. And I'd like to hear your comments about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think productivity would go down. You're absolutely right. We'd, of course, have to wonder whether that was a bad thing, and maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing, though some people would end up poorer. But you're definitely right that part of the problem has been a disappearance of the idea that every life has a certain amount of dignity, that everyone has dignity. This was, you know, a point that traditional religion used to stress, that, as it were, you know, you can serve God from many different, many different ways. This is a traditional message that one would hear from Christian thinkers and other religious believers too. Nowadays, there's very much the idea that the only kind of good life is an extraordinary life. You see this also with the erosion of a sense of a working class pride, the sense of, you know, I will never be rich. I'm a member of the lowest class in my society, but we are very important. We are doing something very important, and maybe we're kind of better in a way than those above us, etc. That kind of working class pride is really under threat. And what you've got is a kind of middle-class value system that's now pervading all levels of society. And the middle-class value system is really that you are what you achieve. And, you know, the more you achieve, the better you are, and the less you achieve, the worse you are. And it's an incredibly exhausting way of looking at things. Economically, it creates great results, because worried people are people who work harder. You know, let's face that fairly and squarely. You know, we work hard because we're frightened. So every time you see a very productive economy, what gets called productive in that kind of very sober language of economics, you're also seeing a very frightened economy. The economy of France is not very productive. Now, one way of looking at that is to say, oh, well, they're just lazy, etc. The other way of looking at that is that they're not that frightened. And so, you know, I think we really have a choice about the sort of society we want to live in. Do we want to live in a frightened, very productive one, or perhaps a not-so-productive but not-so-frightened one?
Well, I agree with you, but another thing that is almost paradoxical is that all animal kingdoms have hierarchies and they have ranking systems and social rankings. And I think we have a propensity to want to be superior to others, and that's kind of ingrained in us to some extent.
Yeah, I'm glad
that's how we identify ourselves. And I think this, but it would almost, we'd have to change innately to do that.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring this up, because I think the news is actually perhaps better than you suggest. I think you're right that we are innately wired to seek high status. That is something that is absolutely within us. But, and I think it's a huge but, there is a lot of freedom about who gets high status and for doing what in societies. And if you look at the history of many different societies, you will see different people earning high status for doing different things. So that, you know, in medieval society, some of the people with the highest status were the very poor who devoted themselves to God. Very unusual idea now. 150 years ago in Britain, if you made money in business, you'd keep that quiet. That was considered a very low status thing. 100 years ago in the United States, if you were a woman, you had quite low status, whereas nowadays you have possibly equal or even higher status than a man. So the status system keeps changing, and that's what politics is all about. Politics is, you know, that area of human affairs where different groups slug it out and basically try and work out who should get high status and for doing what. And there's an awful lot of flexibility in the system. So I would say, you know, yes, there's a fixed desire within us to seek high status, but, you know, we can shift the way that status is accorded in society. There's nothing that tells us that, you know, someone who goes to Harvard Law School must forever, by some biological means, earn higher status than someone else. It's a product of, you know, politics and our political system.
Well, the only complicating thing is that based on the system we have today, which is in America, it reflects the probably one of the utmost capitalistic societies. I don't think the powers that be would like us to be that uncomfortable and where we would erode the system of capitalism.
So, of course, I don't
think this is going to disappear very easily.
Of course. This is why I use the term slug it out. It's a fight. I mean, just as, you know, when feminism got going, there were many people who were not happy at all at the idea of feminism. Or indeed the civil rights movement or whatever. So these things are disputes, they're battles. I mean, hopefully no one gets killed in them, but they are disputes, and it's a question of, you know, upsetting some people who, with an interest in the status quo. So, and you know, that's why political debates can be very vicious.
We're already moving into our last 15 minutes, and I have some other callers. And again, I want to thank the last caller. And let me just ask you to talk about a little bit different area here, because we've been spending a lot of time talking about what status anxiety is and why it is. And that's really only half of the book that you have written. The other half is to say to people, okay, so maybe you're not real happy about status anxiety and you'd like to swim against that tide. How is it that, and what you do is then you go and you look at various kinds of ways of thinking. You look at philosophy, you look at art, you look at religion, you look at politics, and for some advice to people who are interested in maybe throwing off that weight. And it seems that a key point is getting to that point where an individual can say, you know, I really don't care what other people think of me. I have to be the one to define my own worth. And if other people don't think I'm a success, if I think so, that's all that matters. And if they don't think so, well, they can just take a hike. I mean, that's a tough place to get to. But how do you suggest that people think about that?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that that you often hear when you talk to older people is they often say, well, you know, that one of the great things about getting older is that, you know, I care less what other people think about me. And I think by that they mean not just that, you know, they care about what everyone thinks, they don't care about what anyone thinks of them, but rather that they're getting better at focusing on the opinions of some people and of ignoring the opinions of others. And I think that's a real achievement. It's an achievement of maturity, of wisdom. I mean, not it's not an automatic reward of age. It has to be worked at. Quite the opposite of, let's say, children. If you look at children, they're incredibly sensitive to their status, and they worry about what everyone thinks. So I'm not suggesting that worrying about what people think is by itself a terrible thing. It's more the undisciplined nature in which we often do the worrying, that we'll tend to pick up suggestions from all over the shop about who we should listen to. So, you know, we pick up a magazine and suddenly we feel uncomfortable that some part of our life is wrong because the magazine is suggesting it might be, etc. So we focus much more and we resist some of the pressures that will always come at us to change our lives in areas where actually if we take a step back, we'll realize that this is not very helpful. One of the ways in which traditionally people have thought about this is to reflect on how short their life is. To think about death has been one of the traditional sort of initial consoling maneuvers in relation to status anxiety, because anyone who's ever had a close brush with death will tell you that certain things came to seem very important and other things came to seem less important. And one of the things that comes to seem less important does tend to be the one's status within the community. And often one focuses then on other things. So these are some of the thoughts and suggestions that I look at.
We have some other callers. Just real quick, let me again introduce our guest, Alan de Botton. He's a writer. He makes his home in London and is visiting in the United States to talk about his most recent book. Status Anxiety is the title. It's published by Pantheon. He has written a number, several novels, three novels, and also other works of nonfiction, including The Art of Travel, The Consolations of Philosophy, and How Proust Can Change Your Life. Other callers here. The next in line is in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hey, Alan. How are you?
Hi, great.
You know, I just can't tell you how important this is to me because I'm supposed to go to a family reunion this weekend. And, you know, I'm the guy that does children's museums and does art and so forth. And I never quite add up to the accountants and the lawyers in the family, but beyond that, I'm also a PhD candidate in design theory, so I just wanted to put this all in the way I think about it. Complacency, I suppose, at a point, and, you know, I was just going to ask you what you think about places like Target and Walmart and IKEA, where sort of there's a definition of status inbred on which we climb, and I usually use designers and so forth, but if that is the standard and people are trying to outbuy themselves at those places, What does that mean for a culture?
Well, I think it's interesting you mentioned the family reunion and how status anxiety inducing it can be to hang out, you know, in a family grouping with people who've made very different choices, who are leading very different lives. And I talk a little bit about this in my book, the way that how much these encounters can affect us. You know, 10 minutes with, you know, a brother-in-law who, even though he doesn't say this, is basically suggesting that, you know, you are a loser and all your choices are the wrong ones, can sort of have a really heavy toll, heavy psychological toll, just as, you know, 10 minutes flicking through a magazine which has a certain vision of life can be really sort of upsetting and can really take something out of us. So I think we have to be careful who we hang out with, what we read, what we see, you know, what we're watching on television, etc., or even where we go shopping.
What are you saying? I hope you would reinforce my decision to just, as I learned from somebody else British, go late and leave early.
Absolutely, go late and leave early. And I think there's sometimes, you know, because we're constantly thrown together with people in our families and in our friendships, etc., we often meet people who are basically depressing to us and challenge the kind of choices we've made. And sometimes, you know, yes, it might be worth turning down an invitation or saying you're busy or, you know, switching off the television or not reading the magazine or not buying the newspaper or whatever it happens to be, so that you can, as it were, keep faith with your own values and your own projects.
Well, and I guess what you're saying, and I just needed reinforcement for this weekend, is I don't have to like everybody either, do I?
Well, that's absolutely, again, I have a whole chapter in my book.
But that's the important thing to bring across.
That's right. That we often associate being nice to everyone and liking everyone with, you know, being a good person. And maybe actually a good life does mean that you can't carry everyone with you. Maybe you will have to make choices about who you like and who you dislike.
And my favorite, you know, saying was, you know, it's your choice, the bag of rocks you want to carry around, and you can leave them behind.
Right, exactly.
I've enjoyed so much hearing this show and so forth, and I'm going to go out and buy the book.
Fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We'll continue. We have another caller here. The next is in Champaign County. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yes. This is a little, we've talked about mainly the commodity aspect of things and purchasing and stuff, and I guess some of this does devolve to ownership, but I wonder whether you can speculate or whether you treated this in the book, the idea of status as sort of trophy wife kind of thing. We in Illinois, I don't know if you've been following the news, I guess it's on the tabloids in England, this case of candidate for Senate going around with his trophy wife, et cetera. And if he wasn't asking her specifically to exercise, he was at least, you know, trundling around some clubs where, you know, obviously exhibitionism was the biggest item. But
sure,
the other thing I wanted to get to, and maybe there is a way of relating it, is when you accepted the premise that, you know, there's hierarchical. Of course, there's a lot of hierarchies, but what about this argument about the chimps and the bonobos? I don't know if you're familiar with it. Chimpanzees are very hierarchical and very protective of territory. Bonobos, a very similar species whom we share a lot of genes with, are culturally apparently quite not so. So I don't know if you've looked at that. I think it was an English author that actually...
Right, sure.
Go ahead. Thanks.
Definitely, you know, these evolutionary biological arguments can be so twisted, and that's why I'm very wary of them. I mean, I'm fascinated by them, but as you say, there are different kinds of species that we can be most easily compared to, and we must never be passive. We must never use these biological arguments to say, oh, well, that's just biology, so let's give up, sort of thing. I think there's a lot more flexibility. Obviously, we're biologically constrained within some parameters, but within that, there's a lot of choices we can make. You know, we can live like chimpanzees, or we can live like these other types. As for the trophy wife, you know, anything can be turned into a status symbol. Anything which human beings value can become a trophy. So a child can become a trophy. You know, a beautiful picture can. You know, a job can. Anything which people value, and, you know, people value female beauty, people value children, people value jobs. So it shouldn't surprise us. You know, some people have status symbols, you know, they have books of poetry because people value poetry. So, it, you know, anything which is of value, but that isn't to say that the only value of a picture or of a wife, etc., is of being a trophy. It's just, it's something that can follow whenever something is valuable. Whenever something is valuable, it can be twisted into an object that one uses basically to show off.
Well, again, I hope that gets at the comments of the caller. I appreciate his contributing. We're getting down to the point here where we are getting close to our end. And I guess I find myself thinking that it's challenging. Status anxiety is difficult, and it seems that the people who have been most successful, whoever they are, have often been people who are the least conventional, the most willing to go against the tide of society's values, and that they often are the most, interestingly enough, are often some of the most creative people in that society.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a long tradition of the outsider. There's a long and noble tradition of the American outsider, someone who stands outside the big cities, you know, Thoreau most classically, someone who stands outside big city life and, as it were, carves out his or her own value system, etc. It's become ever harder to be that person because of the cost of living, because of the huge growth, urban sprawl, etc. It's become harder to be that sort of frontiers person. But I think we can nevertheless look back, maybe with some nostalgia, but also some inspiration, at people who have been able to live by their own value system. Now, living by your own value system doesn't mean that you will disagree with everything and, you know, stop eating with a knife and fork and wear funny clothes and, you know, become very strange. It might not mean that at all. It literally means reflecting on the values around you. And it's a very basic point, but it's one that it's so easy to miss because we're not encouraged to think that way. But to ask, this vision of the successful marriage or the successful job or the successful life, is it something that I agree with? Does it make sense? In what ways doesn't it make sense? To try and understand the history and the psychology of it all, to become a more conscious human being. And I think that is a very difficult but very noble goal. It's difficult because there's so many pressures in our society to, be distracted, to just check email and read the newspaper and rush around, etc., and not take that step back, not examine, where are we really trying to go, what are we trying to achieve, etc. All that more reflexive direction of the mind is really under threat by many sort of forces in society. So, but that's perhaps the message of my book, Status Anxiety. It's about saying yes, there will always be status, so there will always be status anxiety, but maybe there are better or worse things to be anxious about. Maybe there's better and worse definitions of success, and rather than sucking in uncritically from the environment these notions of success, we should at least submit them to a kind of rational scrutiny before setting our sights and our goals.
Well, we will have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the time. For folks who are interested in exploring these ideas further, look for the book that we have talked about. It's titled Status Anxiety. It's published by Pantheon by our guest, Alain de Botton. You might also look for some of his other books, The Art of Travel, The Consolations of Philosophy, How Proust Can Change Your Life. They are all now available in paper. Should be able to find them in the bookstore. His home is in London. At this point, though, he's spending some time here in the United States traveling around talking about the book. And Alain, thank you very much for talking
with us. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.